Welcome to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld, and this program is about the exploration of the unknown, where we're moving into as an evolutionary race that's moving to a higher dimension of ourselves, of our knowing, of our understanding of the universe. And tonight's guest is really a part of that evolutionary understanding, because he deals with sacred geometry, and sacred geometry is the universal language of creation, of the universe, of the greater mind. So welcome Bruce Rawls to tonight's show. Thank you, Bruce.
Thank you, Alan, for inviting me. This is always always fun to be sharing fun stuff with folks out in the world. And anyway, thanks for the invitation. Appreciate it.
Yes. I met you, five or six years ago in Sedona at the Sacred Geometry Conference?
I think it was eight. Wasn't it 2004?
Oh, was it? I don't know.
Isn't it amazing how time flies? Well, that dream stuff of time, huh?
Yeah, sure. That's a geometry we'll have to look at someday, the geometry of time and how that fits in with the evolution of consciousness, actually. But let's talk about your new book, The Geometry Code, that's just out. And it's just out as an e-book. Can people buy it? How do they find
it? I haven't done the e-book yet, but that'll be forthcoming. I'll put it on Kindle, and I'm thinking of even doing an iPad, at least an excerpt on iPad, just for starters. But right now it's out in print form, and you can go to Create Space and find it there, or Geometry Code or ACM Blog. I've got links to it about everywhere I can think of course.
Well,
anyway.
And then your website, of course, is the geometrycode.com, right?
Exactly.
Right. So this book, you know, there's probably, you know, thousands of books out there on sacred geometry. But what I like about this and what the parts I've read is that somehow you understand the symbolic wisdom embedded in the sacred geometry. Now, when you talk about symbols, what do you mean as far as symbolic wisdom?
Well, you know, I think if we look at everything in our world, it really can be seen as a symbol for a part of ourselves that we've projected out and made into a form of one kind of another. And geometric symbols are just one example of that. But they're kind of everywhere you look. They're ubiquitous. They're you know, just everywhere you turn, you can see geometry in different ways. So I think I started with that because of my wanting to think of things and find things that were universal rather than specific to a culture or a time period or anything like that. I wanted to find things that were actually universal enough that you wouldn't have to relearn something if you went from one place to another or another time to another. And so it's that universality, I think, that really makes it interesting to me, and I think it helps make it applicable to anybody. So that was kind of my aim in looking at these symbols.
Well, when you say universal, it does seem like the circle probably means the same thing to all cultures around the world, the infinite sphere of life. And the square is sort of the groundedness, and triangle represents movement. Is that the kind of symbols you're talking about?
Somewhat. Yeah, I think when I started putting this together, when you and I were in Sedona, I had a fairly different vision of what the book might be. Because the first book, the Sacred Geometry Design Source Book that I had at that time and had been out for a few years, was largely a catalog or a reference book for a lot of different symbols and a little bit of metaphysics behind it. And this book is actually kind of the opposite in one respect, or the complement, hopefully. In that it's largely a metaphysical exploration of going from the form back to the mind, and that basically brings us to these seven hermetic laws that are covered in the book that I remember talking about at that conference too. They're in this book called The Kabbalion that is celebrating, I believe, its 100-year anniversary this year, synchronistically.
Right. Penguin Tartra just republished that, you know.
Oh, really?
In a new version. Yeah.
And you can find it online too. I think I have a link on my website where you can can download the whole thing as a PDF. So for people who want to do that and just kind of familiarize themselves with it. It's these wonderful little laws that apply to everything. And what I found in the interim while I was thinking about what I wanted to put in the book that would be, you know, applicable to everyone and everything and, you know, looking for that universal quality, as it were, is I reacquainted myself with a non-dual metaphysics and in a number of ways. And in particular, I got back into, through Gary Renard's book, who I know you've interviewed.
Yes, The Disappearance of the Universe.
Exactly, yeah. And that book, I was house-sitting for a friend when we were living in Oregon, and a lady that my wife worked with said, hey, I'm looking for somebody to house-sit for, you know, about a week and a half while I go to Hawaii. And at the time, I was commuting, you know, four or five times a week typically between Eagle Point, Oregon, and Ashland, Oregon, where most of my clients were at the time. And I thought, well, sure, why not? I can save a little time and then work on my book while I was house sitting. Well, synchronistically, on my friend Claire's coffee table were both of Gary's books, and I picked up the first one. And also synchronistically, I thought, well, I'll go see this documentary called Living Luminaries. And Don Miguel Ruiz and Marion Williamson and a bunch of people that I was familiar with and appreciated were interviewed on this documentary. And this guy named Gary Renard, and it's like, well, that's interesting. And there's this book, and I couldn't put it down. And what it led me to is basically back to the non-dual metaphysics of A Course in Miracles, which when you pick it up, it kind of reads like a you know, Christian jargon, but if you get past the superficial examination of it, it's like it's really profound non-dual metaphysics that aims at bringing us back to our minds and looking at the awareness that really is behind this phenomenal hologram that we've made up that we call the universe. Mm-hmm. And that recognition and that remembrance really ties into these hermetic laws. And there's really, you know, two thought systems, and that's why I put in one of the first chapters in the book is that there's these seven hermetic laws, but really most importantly, there's two thought systems that make all the difference in the world as to how we interpret all the symbols that come up in our lives. We can either see the world from the through the lens, if you will, or the perspective of inclusiveness, where there's really just one self expressing as multiplicity through the illusory hallucinatory faculties we call our senses, or we can see it as a whole bunch of different things, and there's otherness, and that gives rise to this whole concept of victimization and specialness, and basically a fearful worldview in a nutshell. And I think that's a crucial thing to kind of set the premise for this discussion is what thought system are we working from? Because if you're working from a non-dual thought system, then all the symbols make perfect sense, and the meaning we derive from them is guided by that inclusive inner teacher, if you will, that kindly spirit that we all share, that tells us that we can include everyone, not in a literal sense. It's not like, you know, inviting a potluck and saying, okay, all 7 billion people on the planet are invited. Not terribly practical on that level, but on the level of our mind, if we exclude anyone, that's why I like the circle, and you brought that up is if you could start and finish with that one symbol if you wanted to, because a circle is a great metaphor for inclusiveness when we allow that circle to expand to go beyond the infinite. And when the diameter is infinite, then everything is included. And that's basically the worldview it's very simple and yet very challenging, because we find ourselves looking for basically escape from that worldview, because we have pet grievances and we have our own special pet peeves and so forth, and that's what basically holds this universe together in terms of the prison qualities of it. But once we look at the phenomena, the symbology, or the metaphors, or the mirrors that are in our life, everywhere we turn, from an inclusive thought system, then it completely transforms those symbols into one that is basically healing and comforting, and reminding us that all the things that we've made that seem horrific are really just a silly dream.
Well, I know it's a silly dream, and it's true. What I guess I want to understand is, well, the physical world is a symbol to the soul and to the soul's evolution through a metaphysical reality. And so the geometries are physical representations of metaphysical states of consciousness. That's how I would see it, right?
Sure.
And so do you sort of get into that as these symbols are represented around us? Do they take us to different parts of our own soul? Do you know what I mean? Or aspects?
Absolutely. In fact, I think the concept of soul retrieval is beautifully expressed when we look at an inclusive thought system, because once we work through the idea that nothing really is outside of us, and I think that's part of why I wanted to include a chapter on modern physics, because if you take two pairs of electrons and move them inches apart or galaxies apart, it doesn't matter. Those paired electrons will have the spin angle, the orientation of their axis of spin change instantly, from what I understand. Whether they're, like I say, an inch or a galaxy apart. So,
right.
So
that's non-locality rule.
Exactly. So if you extrapolate that, which is where I think the physicists at Copenhagen were kind of like looking at each other like, now what do we tell the world? Because it basically was saying, the whole space-time notion, combine that with the wave particle duality and the idea that the mind is what is primary, and maybe the ghost in the machine is really the machine, and the mind is primary, and I think that's what any metaphysical system worth its salt is really trying to tell us, is that the world is a phenomenal expression of a mind that is capable of incredible things. I mean, if you really think of this as a giant holographic projection, then what we do moment to moment puts the best CGI houses and special effects companies, movie production companies to shame.
go ahead, finish that, because I
know. It's the power of our mind is phenomenal, and I think that gets into the whole realm of the kind of the Star Trek principle and the original series of the non-interference. I really like that Gene Roddenberry idea that if we really apply that and recognize that it's really our own minds that we're responsible for, and we don't have really any business messing with other people's minds, then that puts the onus back on us to say, okay, well, what am I really responsible for? And we're responsible for what we think of other people. And if we hold the idea that each one of us is all of spirit, not a fraction or a part of it or a partial aspect of it, then we see ourselves through that same vision or that same filter.
Right. I mean, of course, I'm in agreement with all that, and that's sort of the standard metaphysical spiritual route. But what I'm interested in, as far as your expertise, is how geometries then represent essential aspects of the soul's presence in form, as consciousness is present in form, mm-hmm. through these geometric symbols.
Sure.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
So like the golden ratio, the phi ratio, the 1.66, that, would you say that is a symbol of life itself and will always be symbolic of life because that is what generates a living structure? Or am I taking it too far?
Well, I tend to look at those kind of symbols, and I think the golden ratio, which is, like you say, it's about 1.618, and you can take it out to however many decimal places you want. It's actually the exact formula is 1 plus the square root of 5 over 2, if you want, for the math heads and the audience. That proportion, I think, is profound in the sense that it is a reminder of interconnectedness. And the reason I call it that is because the idea is it's the proportion which, when you take a length of something and divide it in such a way that the large to the small is exactly the same ratio as the whole to the large. And if you do the run the quadratic formula on it, which, you know, if anybody wants to do that, you find that it does indeed equal that 1 plus the square root of 5 over 2, which is the 1.618 ratio. And it occurs not only throughout nature, you know, everything from fiddle ferns and chambered nautilus shells and the drone bee populations and daisy seeds and sunflower seed heads and, you know, countless spiral and pentagonal forms. The blossom of every edible fruit is a pentagonal, you know, geometry essentially, because it's a five-pointed flower. It just goes on and on and on. And they found these kind of structures in the pentagons that are part of the dodecahedral structurals of quasi structures of quasi crystals, and even the shape of the universe going the other direction is I've even read that someone postulated that it might be a dodecahedral shape. So it shows up everywhere you can imagine in the natural world, and also it was enshrined not only in, you know, the Renaissance artists like Da Vinci and Raphael and those kind of folks. Certainly the Parthenon in Greece is a classic example, and of course the Great Pyramid. If you take the apothem, which is the proportion between one side of that one of the triangular faces, the line that goes right up the middle of one of the triangular faces of the four-sided pyramid in Giza, Egypt, and then you divide that by one half of the base side, that works out to the golden ratio. So basically, if you take those two triangles that line divides, if you can imagine that, then and flop it over, each face really is a golden rectangle that's just, you know, reassembled in that manner. So it shows up in art and architecture and the natural world and all kinds of places. And I think for good reason, in that it's a reminder that there's this interconnectedness, there's this relatedness. And I think that ties into the idea of inclusion, is that if we have an inclusive thought system where we have shared interests, and those shared interests basically are sort of like training wheels for wholeness or for unity awareness, that bring us to that point where we remember that thinking of our interest in isolation is really believing in an illusory concept. Because really there is no such thing as isolation. If modern physics and ancient mystics are telling us straight, and I believe they are, so.
Well, so you're saying, so the relationship of the smaller part to the larger part is the same as the part to the whole. Is that the idea behind the golden mean?
Exactly. Yeah, this is one example of many, and it crops up at all kinds of places.
Wait. So let me understand. So you're saying the relationship of the limited to the unlimited doesn't change in any part of its system. It's the unlimited is reflected in the limited parts of itself. Is that what you're sort of saying there?
Well, not exactly.
No. Okay. Explain it again.
let me just delve quickly into the pure non-dual metaphysics, and then I'll get back to the stuff that people are probably more interested in.
No, I think they're interested in the metaphysics as well. Okay. No, stay with the metaphysics too.
Because really, all that the symbols can do is point. There's a lady named Caroline Casey who does a show called The Visionary Activist Show, and one of the things that she points to, pun intended, is the metaphor that we oftentimes, you know, worship the finger instead of paying attention to what it's pointing to. And I think that's kind of the way it is with symbols. And that's why one of the very first things that I put in the book is that, you know, sort of this blasphemous idea for probably a good part of my audience, and I'll just quote from the page one of the book here, or actually page two, because I put the graphic on the facing page. I said, isolated forms, shapes, and geometries out of context do not matter. What is important is the underlying meaning or purpose we give to them, and any other symbolic mirrors, metaphors, and representations in our life. And I think that's it. Is that symbols again? It basically depends on the thought system that we use, that either becomes a training wheel for system for training our mind to remember the wholeness by trusting in inner teacher of kindness, if you will, and then learning to listen to that voice to
move toward shared interests as opposed to isolated and separate interests.
Wait, but is it the meaning we give to them, or do they have inherent meaning as in terms of interacting with consciousness itself? That's what I'm trying to understand.
Yeah, I think, again, that it ties into the thought system idea, is that in terms of the typical everyday thought system of our egoic mind, if you will, we can make up all kinds of meanings. And that's where it becomes less than universal. And that's where I tend to think, well, okay, sure, you know, there can be things that mean certain things for certain cultures, and that's fine, and you know, why not? But what happens if you're on, you know, a different galaxy or whatever? And not that I have consciously been aware of those kinds of things, but if you, and probably most people, you know, listening to this probably think this is pretty far out, I think the idea is if we have a perspective where we can think about what would really be the same for anyone, regardless of you know, where they come from, and I think that brings us to looking for generalizing the meanings of symbols. And so I think a circle, again, you could start with that one by thinking, well, okay, what in its finite state, you know, a diameter less than infinity, let's say, we can look at what's within the circle and what's out without the circle. And that's, you know, again, either a seat of duality by saying, well, whatever's outside is in the goatscape, if you will, and everything inside is in the lambscape, to coin a metaphor. And then we could use that to either reinforce the dualistic idea of the haves and the have-nots, or the inner circle and the outer circle of our heart or mind, whatever you want to call it. Or we could look at the circle as a way of saying, oh, here's where I'm separating things out and making distinction between things within this dreamscape that we've made. Mm-hmm. That really artificial.
Well, what I'm trying to understand is, and I do believe there is a conscious life throughout the universe and on many dimensions of thought and reality, and they're probably intersecting with our fields all the time. Sure. Is there a agreed upon geometries that are symbols to sentience itself, to consciousness itself, that then makes geometry a universal language throughout the multiverse, all the universes of, or is it an aspect, like you said, something we create through conscious intention? My guess is it has some innate relationship to the superconscious mind.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. I don't know. What do you say?
Yeah, I think there is something to that, and a lot of times a good examples of that in my mind are the crop circles, because yes, there's a lot of those formations that intuitively have a certain kind of quality to them that you know, it's difficult to put into words, but there you get a feeling from looking at those that seems to be more direct than the language that we use, for example.
Mm. Well, I was going to ask you about them. Okay, go ahead, finish what you're saying. Yeah.
Oh, well, that was pretty much it. Is that, you know, it just seems like there's you know, certain archetypal patterns that have those kind of qualities. For example, you know, you mentioned triangles and squares and spirals, and there's lots of shapes that seem to have a quality that evokes certain aspects of consciousness. That again, and I think that's why there are specific symbols that can be used as reminders for these natural laws, and that's why I put this book together as a way of saying, well, why don't we look at some of these natural laws, of which there are seven. There's the law of mentalism, correspondence, vibration, polarity, rhythm, cause and effect, and gender generation, and each of those are universal in their application, and there's symbols that can be paired with those. And these are, again, something that came through just meditating on what would be an appropriate symbol. So they're not hard and fast rules, but just something that I made up, if you will. But I think they go pretty well with these. And the symbol of a circle with the law of mentalism could be a pretty nice metaphor for the fact that if our mind is inclusive, then that circle expands to embrace and encompass all of life from that kindly integrative holistic paradigm, if you will.
Well, let me just explain that in the law of mentalism, it says that the mind is all and the all is mind, and that's
exactly.
The first law. And
exactly.
The circle, I guess, would be the best symbol to represent that all-inclusiveness.
I think so. I mean, the choice of these is somewhat arbitrary, but I try to pick things that intuitively and rationally made the most sense for you know, what would be a good candidate anyway. Let's put it that way for at least the starting point for conversations around, you know, what could be a good symbol for these laws. And so that's kind of why I had fun putting it together. You know, as I was putting this book together, like I say, a few years ago, this non-dual metaphysics came into play, and as a forefront of conversation, and I realized that the thought system that we use is crucial in terms of what we get out of it, because one way will lead us into a greater sense of entrapment and imprisonment, and the other thought system will take that very same symbol and bring it into a light that's liberating and freeing.
Right. I think that's very important to understand. Our reality is to understand the thought system that we're using to operate in the reality. But of course, nature transcends thought system. Nature uses these symbols to create life and the variety of life all around us. And I think they also use it to structure consciousness. I think thoughts form worldviews, actually are encoded with their own geometric frequencies. I mean,
sure.
That's what it seems to me. I don't know. There's no way to prove that. But I did want to talk a little bit about the crop circles that you mentioned, because in 2010 I was in England and I was in crop circles too.
Uh-huh.
Well, one particularly that was in the shape of a Metatron cube.
Uh-huh.
So I'd love for you to talk about what is a Metatron cube? How does it relate to the seven laws, and why is it so special?
Well, the Metatron formation is kind of cool because it basically it ties into the flower of life and that whole symbology, and which is neat in that if you look at the interconnections between those patterns and those vertices that this symbol made out of, essentially for the listeners that are not familiar with it, there may be some that aren't, the flower of life pattern can be generated from the seed of life pattern, which is basically taking a circle. And then, and the best way to do this really is the experiential way with a compass and a piece of paper, and taking the compass and drawing a circle, and then moving the point of the circle to the perimeter, and the needle point, whatever you call that, the one that doesn't have the pencil or the lead in it, and then that, while still keeping the same radius or diameter, then drawing another circle, and then that first circle becomes the generator for the second circle, which the two together create this shape called the Vesica Pisces. And that is referred to as the lens or the mandorla. It's an almond shape. It also shows up in everything from the stomata of plant cells, which is the respiratory orifice, our mouths, our eyes, our genitalia. You can go on and on. It just shows up everywhere in nature as an interface, which is very appropriate because that is and I think that really ties into the law of correspondence, as above, so below, as within, so without. And so, and you were talking a moment ago about the idea that consciousness is structured by form. Well, maybe basically we've made form in order to resonate with the structures of our awareness and then reinforce our own beliefs. That'd be another way of looking at it.
That's a good kind of place to speculate on, because I think that there has to be a kind of universality to it. I think so too.
And the whole premise with a lot of non-dual metaphysics is that the cause really is the mind or our awareness that then gives rise to the form, and we forget that there's a feedback loop going on there. We kind of forget. The analogy I like to use lately is when we look at the screenplay of our life, we we you know occasionally will glance down at the inner screenplay, and then somewhat reluctantly admit that our signature is there on every page. And it's like, oh yeah, that's right. This alleged reality is a feedback mechanism for my own awareness to tell me what I've either still have a grievance or a grudge or judgment about, or not, you know, as the case may be. And so and again, that's again where this correspondence or this second hermetic law of as above, so below, as within, so without, ties into this second circle in the Vesica Pisces, making the Vesica Pisces that, again, if you start going around the whole circle and then using the intersection points on that second circle, moving your compass point there and making several more circles, you now have seven or six around one, which then becomes the seat of life. And then if you continue that pattern, making another dozen around the first seven, you have the pattern called the flower of life, which was burned into the giant granite monoliths in the temple of Abydos. The Assyrian temple, it was predates the Ptolemaic temple, those newfangled ones that were only 4,000 or 5,000 years old.
Is that true? Because I know Greg Braden came out with that, and I'm not sure where he got that from. Is it true that actually was burnt in, or did
I walked up to it and looked at it when I was on tour with Greg 20 years ago.
Oh, you did.
20 years ago this November, yeah. And you know, if it was painted on, you would think it would have worn off, you know, by now. Because that whole temple complex was unearthed, some time ago, but it was buried, from what I understand, for quite a while. When you look at it, it looks like it's part of the rock. So I don't know. Maybe it was burned. Maybe it was etched. I don't know. But it obviously was intended to be there for a long time. But regardless of the mechanism by which that image was placed on that giant granite monolith, which makes up one of many granite monoliths that makes up that Assyrian complex, it was obviously pretty intentional. And that form, when you get the six around the one and then the 12 additional circles, you have this pattern called the flower of life, which Drimvalo Melchizedek has popularized, done a great job of you know, showing how there's all kinds of really interesting geometric relationships, including the five Platonic solids, which are, if you take again, looking at generalities and universalities and trying to generalize things that are true everywhere, when you look at the shapes in three dimensions that are the same in every little part of each part of it, and you look at the things made out of line segments that are the same length, it turns out that there are five, and only five, and exactly five shapes, and those were attributed to Plato because he was the first one who, you know, in our historical accounts, was credited with quote-unquote discovering them. And the cube is the most familiar, but then you have the tetrahedron, which is a three-sided pyramid made out of four triangles. Interestingly enough, that shape, if you superimpose it on the Earth, you get a plus and minus 19.5-degree latitude lines going around.
Wait, if you superimpose what on the Earth?
If you superimpose a tetrahedron, which is one of these five Platonic solids,
tetrahedron. Oh, you mean the triangle? It's a three-dimensional triangle, basically.
Yeah. Basically, you take an equilateral triangle, and then right. I mean, you can make it. If you go to geometrycode.com, I've got some fold-up patterns, and anybody who wants to cut these out and fold them up, you can play with them and have fun with them. And but they're very ubiquitous. They show up in all kinds of not only polycrystalline, you know, atomic geometries, but also in other forms throughout nature at different scales. And like I was mentioning earlier, the dodecahedron, which is probably the most esoteric of the bunch. Plato attributed to spirit or ether, and that's the shape that now some scientists are saying may represent the entire cosmos, which is kind of fun. I don't know if what the relevance of it is, but I think that one thing that was kind of cool with Plato's attribution of the four classic elements plus the spirit ether of the integrative one of the dodecahedron, the cube was representing Earth in Plato's system. The tetrahedron represented fire. Now, where I was going with the 19.5-degree latitude lines is if you take one point of this tetrahedral shape, which imagine a three-sided pyramid, one point is it's either the North Pole or the South Pole. But let's say you pick the North Pole, then the other three points, if you superimpose that over a spherical globe, they end up at, I think it's 19.47 degrees, which if you look at an atlas or a map of the Earth or just go online, you can see that there are a lot of volcanic activities, including Mauna Kea and Mexico City and a bunch of places around the world that have volcanoes. And interestingly enough, when we were in Hawaii some years ago, I asked the resident park ranger who was giving us a little tour from Maui, and we were looking over at the island, the big island across the way, and she was saying that over the millennia, the location of the volcanoes has stayed the same, but the islands, because of continental drift, have moved. And I thought, well, that's interesting. So basically, the hot spot, if you will, or the fiery spots of these tetrahedral points has, from what she was saying, what I gather anyway, has stayed around that 19.5-degree latitude line. So you'd have the South Pole would represent the 19.5-degree north latitude points for that tetrahedron, and then the opposite.
Right. Richard Hoagland made that sort of popular. He says, actually, on every planet in the solar system at the 19-degree mark, there seems to be some kind of unusual activity, the red spot on Jupiter.
As well as the only active volcano on – the other active volcano in our solar system on Jupiter's moon Io, from what I understand, that was about 19.5 degrees.
Right. So, I mean, if this is true, of course this is true, but if the reason we can speculate is that there could be some kind of a tetrahedral energetic form embedded within the Earth, the sphere, these planets itself, that seems to be the hypothesis. Is that true? Are you going there with that?
Well, I think on some energetic level, there may be, if you will, a fiery consciousness that relates to those particular latitudes, and then the other three were the icosahedron, which is 20 sides, the octahedron, which is 8 sides, and the dodeca, which is 12 sides and made out of pentagons.
But I'm just saying, is there overlaid over our physical realities, these energetic structures that are creating and affecting form? I mean, there's no way to prove that right now, but would you speculate that something like that was happening? We're overlaid with geometries all the time, is I guess what
I would say that our consciousness within this universe, reflects through form the nature of or the quality of the thoughts that bring those forms into manifestation. So
So let's go through the rest of the seven laws. So you have the circle as the first law of mentalism.
Uh-huh.
The mind is all and the all is mind. The second law is the Vesica Pisces, which is as above, so below. And then
right.
The third law is
vibration,
which is everything vibrates, the whole
exactly nothing rests, and that again brings up the whole idea of in a dualistic system everything is in motion, nothing stays the same, everything vibrates, everything has a resonant quality or a spectra, if you will, and yet our true essence is still it's the point in the middle of the circle. It's the fulcrum or the still point, the center of the cyclone kind of thing, that allows us to, from that vantage point, see all vibrations as reflections of a unity, if you will.
So is that where you use the point to represent the third law?
Well, I think you could use a sine wave to represent the third law because it's actually a good metaphor for that. A triangle would work well too. I mean, that's basically the whole idea of trigonometry, where we get the sine wave is basically just a rotating point, but you're referencing something above a dualistic system. And that kind of leads us into the next law, which is the law of polarity, which mm-hmm. I think could be represented nicely by a line or a square or anything that has opposites. So when we think about everything has poles or opposites, and that's true within a dualistic system. And so basically, it's really a matter of, do we want to use the opposites of things as a means to justify our grievances and our issues with things and keep others within our own minds separate? Or do we want to recognize that, as the Kabbalion says, everything has its pairs of opposites, like and unlike are the same. Opposites are identical in nature, but different in degree. Extremes meet, all truths are but half-truths. All paradoxes may be reconciled. And, of course, the place where they become reconciled is from an awareness that is dimensionally elevated, if you will, above the duality. Or I kind of like the Alice in Wonderland metaphor of the Cheshire Cat, who's kind of looking down on the chessboard. You know, this matrix of opposites, of conflict. And when we're above the battlefield, which is another favorite section in A Course in Miracles, we're basically looking at our own follies from the perspective of seeing that our personas and our personalities, all our individual issues and needs and wants really are all predicated on the idea that, you know, there's someone must win and someone must lose kind of thing. And yet there's another way of looking at the world that basically says, well, if I could come from a place of shared interest, then I can use this law of polarity instead of to further the conflict in my mind. I can use it to undo that, to reconcile the paradoxes, as the Kabbalion states, or to recognize that really the important thing is not the differences, but the sameness, the identical in nature. That if we see the common ground or the shared interest with what we're doing and what someone else is doing, then we recognize that what others express that may not be to our liking really is a request for kindness or, you know, calling out for love, if you will. That is sometimes difficult to see, but from that perspective, from that Cheshire Cat inner grin, with training, with the repetition, we can then begin to see that everything is in our life, not in some random manner, but in incredibly synchronistic fashion, that we have chosen all the actors and all the characters intentionally to give us opportunities to forgive ourselves for having, you know, projected things outside ourselves.
Right. So that brings us to the fifth law then, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. which is
the law of rhythm.
So in a way, let me just ask you about the whole philosophy of the Kabbalah on these seven sacred laws. There's sort of, if the mind is all and the all is mind, which is the first law, then why do we need these other laws? What's the relationship?
That's a really good question. And the short answer, which sounds kind of flippant, but it really isn't, is you don't.
Okay.
I mean, and that's why, you know, there's one of my favorite teachers of A Course in Miracles, Ken Wapnick, says, you know, if you get the first of the 50 miracle principles in that wonderful, you know, metaphysical classic, which is there's no order of difficulty in miracles, if you really understand that, you don't even need the, you know, the other 49 or the rest of the 600 pages or the other three volumes.
True. If you really understand that the mind is all and the all is mind, if you really, really get that,
right,
and you don't need anything else. But
right, but being creatures, yes, of habit, which ties into this fifth law of the law of rhythm, you know, we have overtrained ourselves so successfully because of, you know, this, and it ties into that the prime directive thing of non-interference. Is if you go in and try to, you know, help someone else or fix someone other than self by interfering, you're basically depriving them of the recognition of the potency of their mind, the fact that each of us individually and collectively has made up a whole universe. I mean, that's a powerful thing. So if you were to, you know,
take that away from someone, you would be basically saying, "Oh well, you don't have any power. You're the helpless creature. You're at the whim and the mercy of things outside of your control. This whole universe of phenomena and effect, and you know, poor little you." And then that would just basically reinforce the victimization. But by repetition of the process of what Gary Renard, and I love his term quantum forgiveness, is basically by taking the insights from modern physics and recognizing that as physicist John Wheeler says, you know, there's no out there out there. And if you can do that for space and say, okay, all the things that I appear to be experiencing in my sensory world are manifestations or projections of my mind, then, you know, being upset with somebody else obviously doesn't get me anywhere, and in fact actually furthers the imprisonment paradigm. So the only way to turn it around really is to basically bring it back inside, or, you know, if you want to use the soul retrieval or integration or, you know, holifying or whatever you want to call it, but basically dissolving the belief in separation that exists between the alleged self and the alleged other. That then brings us to the other aspect of it, is the temporal thing, is if we basically have, you know, an eternal existence, then this little blip on the radar of, you know, maybe a century or a little bit more if we take good care of our bodies, is really, you know, as the Beatles said, nothing to get hung about. And we can, if we can cultivate that kind of lighthearted approach. And again, granted, there's plenty of things that, you know, it's perfectly, you know, appropriate to take seriously. But if there can be just this gradual increase of using this law of rhythm, of every time something comes around of the same nature, the same quality, like the seasons, you know, and when that thing comes around in that same aspect, you know, the same place on the wheel, so to speak, and you react a little bit less out of blame or like the Calvin and Hobbes, I think he's the one that came up with the blame thrower, the weapon that we use to try to torch our dream world instead of just forgiving it. Each time we reinforce that, it becomes a little easier, and we loosen our white knuckle grip on a prison mindset that we made up. So that's where the law of rhythm comes in, is every time it comes around, just being willing to look at our resistance to hanging on to grievances and hanging on to victim scripts and all that kind of stuff. And I think a symbol for that is a spiral that works really well is if we look at the path that the Earth actually traces through the galaxy, it's not a circle, it's really a helix. And you know, looked at that as you know, through the tunnel of time, that helix basically, you know, meanders off into that vanishing point, if you will. So if we look at every time we come around, if we project a little less grievance, or just forgive ourselves, because it's really difficult to undo the habit in terms of the behavior. But I think in terms of just watching ourselves and being mindful, I think that can be really huge. And then pretty soon that, you know, the behavior kind of drops away of itself. It's like, wow, what am I don't need that anymore. That's not getting me anywhere. So a spiral can be a nice metaphor for looking at repetitive habitual patterns, whether it's when you wake up in the morning and you say, "Oh, here I am," the habit of saying, "Oh, what a surreal and fun adventure this can be," by not taking things personally and looking at this as a really happy classroom, seen from that, you know, seen from the eyes, if you will, of our inner teacher of kindness that we all share. So I think that can be a nice metaphor, if you will, of just going around that spiral, you know, and every time that we forgive ourselves for judging and you know, making up an excuse for victimization, and just watching that and saying, "Oh yeah, I guess I could maybe do a little less of that." then it becomes easier and easier each time around to loosen that grip on that identity that really doesn't serve us.
What do you think of toroids? I mean, like, I just want to explain. Nassim Harmim, if you know his
I've met him
physics.
Several times.
Uh-huh. He says the physics of the universe is based on toroidal forms. So
right.
What do you think?
I think there's a lot to that. In fact, one of the things that Nassim talks about that I think totally resonates with me, in addition to some of the work that he and Elizabeth Rauscher have done, talking about the golden ratio proportions between astronomical, major astronomical archetypes, I guess you'd say, galaxies, superclusters, planetary orbits, solar systems. Apparently there's some significant relationships there. But also, one of the things that even more importantly I think is profound, if you again take the, him as one of the modern physics pioneers, looking at the idea that inside every atom is a singularity and a mini black hole, white hole combo. That's like, wow, that speaks volumes of the metaphysics behind the idea that we made up the universe and every single point in it holographically is a projection, if you will, of this vast hallucinatory special effects psychodrama that we're experiencing daily, that we can look at as, something gently laughable or something terrifying, or anywhere in between, depending on how we want to see it. But the singularity idea is, I think, phenomenally useful because it's basically saying that from the standpoint of all-inclusiveness, the fear, if you will, can wink out. I mean, the matter antimatter, if you will, of duality becomes a moot point when we touch on or have these mystical experiences where from time to time we realize that our interests are no different from anyone else's interest, and that quality of connection that we can have with other people sometimes is essentially dissolving the barriers of the duality. And I think that's basically where the egoic self, if you will, in those moments, some might call them holy encounters, miracle moments, mystical experiences. Those can be examples of the dualistic aspect of things winking out, which is what a singularity that is inside every black hole is. And that's where Nassim, I think, is on the right track of saying that, well, if the universe really is a mental projection, then it really is, we're breathing life into it. I mean, even in the Christian Bible, it says, God breathed life into, that whole thing, something to that effect. But we breathe life into every single thing that we give attention to or importance to. And I think that ties us into our sixth law, the law of correspondence, the law of cause and effect. And that basically states that all effects have a cause and all causes have an effect. And we essentially are at the mercy of effects if we believe that they are controlling us, if we forget that the other half of the feedback cycle, that, when things come back to us, it's because, we've launched them. They're a response to something that we've already determined. And I think that's where the idea prejudice comes in. There's another phrase I'm looking for.
When you make an assumption about a thing you're talking about.
Exactly. Yeah. There's a phrase that'll come to mind at some point. That the idea that we've already made up our minds basically about what we want to experience, and sure enough, that's what we experience. I mean, if you just watch your mind and begin to notice how often that if you go into a situation looking for trouble or looking for an argument, sure enough, there it is. But if you already have forgiven yourself for the idea of, maybe I don't have to make this a battle. Maybe I can not only embrace the other's perspective, but also look for a peaceful resolution, not necessarily on a level of form, but in your mind, that you've already decided in advance that you're going to be peaceful no matter what. And sure enough, that plays out.
So the seventh law, the seventh and final law is what?
Gender or generation, basically the idea that all things propagate according to their nature. And, you know, for example, if you plant an apricot pit, you're not going to get barley. And if you plant a sunflower seed, you're not likely to get a sheep. You know, things kind of follow their genetic patterns. And the word gen, I think, is really an interesting word because it's the root of genetics and gender and generation, and but also generalization, which is basically is if we look at what is common throughout all systems, we recognize that there are, again, universal things. And that's what I keep finding interesting more and more, is that the things that are universal are the things that don't change. And if what we are is truth and truth doesn't change, then anything that we would use to limit ourselves to something that's bounded by space or time or bodies or personas or individual identities, then, well, it's kind of changeable. Nothing wrong with that. You know, we certainly have you know, brilliantly conceived a world that reinforces that. But when we can catch ourselves doing that and just say, oh, does that really serve me? And then kind of ease up on that more and more, we find that it's very freeing.
So if you take all these laws and all these forms, how does it help us? Does it give us more control of our reality and ourselves? What does it do?
Well, that kind of gets back to that very first disclaimer in that I put in this geometry code book, is that the forms themselves don't do anything in isolation. And out of the context of inclusion, anything, any symbol, whether it's geometric or a person or an event that just happened in your life, or, you know, anything is really a symbol or a metaphor or a mirror of an inward condition. And the resonances and the forms and the structures that we understandably so, fascinated with, really are just giving form to a mental picture that we've already made. And there's so many different metaphysical systems that talk about that in different ways, but they all kind of, to generalize, to even tie into that seventh law, to find what's true throughout and to generate what is true that doesn't change, to go beyond the dualistic application of the law. It requires us to look at what is within us that never changes, and that's where a lot of the meditative practices come in. And we can meditate on symbols, we can look at forms, and if we find them comforting in that way, you know, more power to it. Because everybody is going to have a different meaning about things, and that's why I say these are just guidelines, and your mileage may vary, and all that kind of stuff. Because the forms themselves are not the big deal. The big deal is really the identity that we choose. And if we choose an inclusive identity, then the meaning that's within those symbols, whether it's geometric, whether it's, you know, something someone sends you in an email, or you hear on the news, or, you know, the Scrabble letters you get that suddenly pop out and say something amusing. It's happening to me lately. And it doesn't matter. Anything, it could be a song lyrics that you hear on the radio. Suddenly the dimensional depth to those meanings will then just pop out at you from an inclusive thought system.
Because those are the meanings we give it culturally. We are, embedded culturally, but like I said before, I do think there are universal meanings as they apply to consciousness itself, and I think that's what's evolving. You know, culture is static, but, you know, I mean, it's evolving too, but consciousness is what's evolving the cultural perspectives. So I think something like Metatron's cube represents a kind of multidimensional. I mean, supposedly it has some angelic meaning as well, and Metatron being a high archangel. I mean, do you know the associations with Metatron itself and Metatron's cube, and why that would be a reference there?
You know, I know there are people who have really gotten into that, and it's just not something that I've been drawn to. And if it works for people, great. You know, I think we all have unique ways of finding our path home and discovering, you know, what works for us and that sort of thing. And that's why, you know, this book isn't for everyone. You know, the geometry obviously isn't for everyone. In fact, most people kind of give me the little cross in front of the, you go away, you know, you'll still.
No, but it is for everyone. They just don't know it. I mean, geometries are for everyone because they're made of geometries, right?
Sure, I mean, of course, yeah. And I want this to be a voluntary thing. I don't want to foist any, you know, concepts anyway, but for those who are interested, I think there are some universal metaphors that we can apply. And so for example, the last symbol I thought, you know, might be a good example of, the law of gender generation is taking the yin yang symbol, the classic oriental mandala, if you will, and then taking that and looking at the fractal qualities of it. So for example, if you imagine a circle, and then you imagine, at the center of that circle, one circle exactly half the diameter or half the radius, on one side and the other, side an exact, the similar circle on the other side, and then it, typically what's done is you erase, or if you will, you fill in the half of each of those smaller circles in a way that's complementary in the sense that it gives you that yin-yang shape where you have a kind of an S-shaped curve, but not the mirrored S, if you will. And so if you imagine that whole geometric mandala, if you will, and then take that and divide it by two and then replace it again with the other two circles and then keep doing that, you discover you have a whole genetic progression. And I think that's kind of an interesting metaphor for, you know, the fact that we have two parents, four grandparents, eight great-grandparents, and then it gets to 16, 32, and then it seems like, and this is something that always puzzled me, it seems like if you keep doing that, then the population explosion is going backwards in time, not forward. So I've never figured that one out. If someone can tell me how that works.
Oh, I see what you mean. You're right, because we had, four grandparents, eight great-grandparents.
Yeah, pretty soon you get up into, you know, much more than 7 billion people, and it's like, okay, something's got to give here in that mathematics. I know there's explanation for that, but it's just something kind of fun to ponder. But
that is good.
The idea that we have a fractal quality, that everything that we do touches everything else, and I think that's one of the things that is neat about holography and fractals is that again, it talks about that interrelatedness and that interconnectedness, which I believe is a wonderful training wheel, that idea of shared interests for pure non-duality, which our minds just, you know, totally don't grok in one sitting.
Well, do you
one lifetime, or maybe a lot of lifetimes, but
so your book goes into more detail about each of these forms and the seven correspondences to these spiritual laws. But do you think that it's not arbitrary?
Rather than people, you know, give the impression for people that it's mostly about geometry, that's why I put the disclaimer at the beginning is the geometry is a backdrop, and that's why, you know, there's about a dozen geometric images in the book. I also put in a labyrinth and a spiralish kind of a spiral. Pseudo spiral, is that the right word? Pattern that was inspired by a fellow named Alex Marchand, who has this wonderful little comic book called "The Universe Is a Dream," and he talks about how forgiveness basically, you know, decreases the diameter using that metaphor of how far we're out on the un-merry-go-round of chasing after something that never fulfills us, kind of thing. But anyway, you started talking about the geometric metaphors
are a geometrist. I mean, our first interview really went deep into the aspects of geometry and consciousness. No, but I think maybe these aren't just arbitrary personal attributes. Maybe you've really captured a sort of universal understanding of some of these codes in relationship to these spiritual laws. I mean, that's a possibility.
I don't really claim that the symbols are universal, but I think that the ideas behind the undoing of some of the thoughts that you know keep us trapped and feeling hopeless and victimized, that are all things under our control. Fortunately, the locus of control. When we use that thought system with geometric reminders as part of our little toolkit, if you will, you know, why not use geometry? I mean, I think that the symbols I've chosen are probably, you know, fairly useful, but I certainly wouldn't want people to think that, you know, these are the only ones that could be used to represent these laws or anything else. They just seem to kind of jump out at me as obvious candidates. So, anyway, I had fun with it, and I don't want anybody to make a big deal out of those anymore than.
No, I mean, it's a way of learning. It's a way of really learning. And I think it's a lot of fun. Yeah. And you have a lot to teach people about understanding consciousness in the universe. And it's a way of understanding ourselves. When we understand these great laws, we understand ourselves in terms of us being spiritual entities here to understand the nature of consciousness itself. I mean, that's what and the mysteries of the world. So these are keys to understanding the mysteries. I mean, they're not the answer, but they're keys to going deeper into aspects of that.
Sure. And again, with the caveat that any symbol is only a symbol and only a reflection of something that is a decision that we've already made on some level, typically unconsciously. But I think the more that we bring those consciously to mind and reconcile our issues with whatever seems to be coming up, whether it's obviously a geometric symbol is an abstract one and it's kind of easy to practice on, which is why it might be useful for a lot of people to start working with those. But when it comes to, you know, long-term relationships where we've had, major issues throughout lifetimes, or at least maybe just this one lifetime, you know, that's probably plenty for most people. And look at some of those things and say, well, gee, how am I using this symbol to reinforce a quality of feeling that doesn't serve me? And how could I turn instead that around, and using those symbols or those mirrors of this cosmic psychodrama that we've brilliantly architected for ourselves, and forgot that we were, you know, basically denied our authorship. and that's why I like the screenplay metaphor. It's like, you know, you look down that screenplay inside every once in a while, I was like, oh yeah, that's my signature on every page there. You know, I was like, okay, I think I can fess up to that. And then that's that.
Well,
that
obviously it is. It is our signature on every page, on every second and every moment, that because we're consciously or unconsciously creating reality.
Right. And letting ourselves off the hook is key. And that's why I in recent years have really become, a renewed enthusiasm for the idea of the quantum forgiveness that Gary Renard's work talks and espoused in A Course in Miracles and those kind of non-dual thought systems like apparently the Vedanta has been, you know, talking about this for millennia, you know, the Advaita Vedanta. I'm not really that familiar with, other than knowing that that's apparently what it's about. So, you know, it's been around forever. I mean, the form isn't important, but the concepts are crucial.
Well, I think we have to wrap up. I mean, this has been, you know, quite an in-depth study into the laws of reality itself. So how can people get the book again?
Oh, sure. It's on CreateSpace, and you can also go to Amazon and find it there. If you go to geometrycode.com, there's links to it there. I also have it on ACIM blog and then my personal blog, which is brucerawls.com. And anyway, yeah, this is, it's just some fun that I had put together. I put up a little YouTube video the other day on some of the books that inspired me, which include the ones I mentioned earlier, as well as some of the early influences like The Secrets of the Great Pyramid and This Living Earth and Robert Lawler's book. And you know, so many different things all kind of fit into it. And, of course, The Kabbalion, which really is talking about these laws that apply to everyone. And, again, it's our thought system. It's one of these two thought systems of inclusion or exclusion that really makes all the difference. And that's why it was going to be a very different book a few years back when I first started on it. And so I'm really glad that I kind of got the the non-dual hit.
Well, what's the most important thing you learned when you were writing this book? That's what I'd like to know.
I think that's a great question, Alan. Thank you for asking that. I think the thing that I learned is how important it is for me to apply this. I mean, because I'm starting to begin to actually believe myself that this theory might actually work.
The theory being what? What's the theory?
The theory of applying kindness and recognizing that everything that I see is a projection of an inward condition, and that the cause and effect principle, if you will, and the Mendelism, and they really are all just different ways of talking about that same universal truth that we all are. And from that vantage point, kindness becomes an obvious choice, and it's like if self and other are identical. If we use that mathematical equation, which is what interconnectedness leads us to, and modern physics leads us to inexorably, then the only conclusion that makes any sense, and certainly the only sane one, is that kindness is, like the Dalai Lama says, a really simple and effective religion, and why not practice it?
What would be the symbol of kindness?
Oh gosh, I think it goes beyond symbols.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
The only danger is of putting this book out is I don't want people to think that the symbols are the big deal. You know, it's like, you know, these are like placeholders or mnemonic aids.
Right. They're the finger pointing to the moon, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And years ago, I read Secrets of the another book. Actually, it's the Life and Teachings of the Master of the Far East, and they were talking about when you climb up the steps of the staircase, you don't take each step with you, you know, and carry it on your back, you leave it for the next person, you know, and I think that's a great metaphor too, is, you know, the symbols, once we get we get what they're trying to tell us, we don't need to hang on to them, and they change dynamically for us depending on the context, but the principles behind them we start to generalize those, and I think that's where the real potency comes in, is we recognize that there really is no order of difficulty when we find the universal laws and the universal keys that really the placeholders are just reminders of.
And how do people find you again, Bruce?
Oh, sure. It's just geometrycode.com. My personal blog is brucerawls.com, and then the one that's devoted to A Course in Miracles, which really gets into the non-dual metaphysics, is ACIM blog for A Course in Miracles blog, and I'm also active on Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn, all those kind of things too. So
Bruce Rawls, Rawles. Well, thanks. What's coming?
Well, this,
what's
coming? This is always fun.
What's coming up for you?
Well, let's see. I'm going to be doing a couple of presentations in the San Francisco Bay Area. One for the Foundation for Mind Body Research. That's going to be the. Let's see, which one is first? Oh, that one's the end of July, the Friday in Palo Alto, I believe, and then the following weekend in San Francisco for the Frobel Conference. This is Scott Boltman invited me to speak there on the geometry of interconnectedness and inclusion, and they make these toys that are apparently very popular in Korea and other parts of the world, and that are geometric toys, and so I'll just kind of tie that into that non-dual thought system and inclusion and all that good stuff. So I'll be having lots of multimedia stuff to go with it as well. Kind of expand.
So stay in touch, Bruce.
Well, absolutely. Yeah. And it was a fun synchronicity that reminded me to connect with you. And again, I really appreciate the opportunity to share with you and your listeners, all this fun stuff.
Good. I'll let you know when this is posted, and I hope this gets the word out and people can use this to empower their lives.
Great. Well, thanks again.
Okay, thanks, Bruce. This is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. If you want to reach me, you can email me at newrealities@earthlink.net or check my website, newrealities.com. Thanks for listening, and same time next week. Tune in. Thank you. Good night.
Waking up in the middle of my life, nothing's what it seems. I feel the fire come alive. Feel the fire
in the fire.
Come alive.
In the fire.